Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to convene the Property and Local Tax Division. Both my apologies and my appreciation to everyone for the room change, and particularly my thank you to staff for accommodating the room change, especially what's already been a crazy week, as well as a particularly crazy day. Representative Slocum presented a bill in education policy this morning and started by saying, "My, you all look tired." And she also said she looked in the mirror and found the same outcome there this morning.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you. I'll move to forgive you.
Thank you very much. We're not voting on that. I'm not sure how it would come out. So we're going to rearrange the schedule slightly to accommodate Representative Hansen, who's currently presenting a bill in another committee. So we're going to start. The chair will move House File 2689 to be before the committee and considered for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Simonson, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and my comments will be brief, but essentially House File 2689 will do two things. One, it will correct a drafting error that was made in calculating formula aid in the statutes when we passed the revision to the local government aid formula last year. That essentially impacts LGA losses to city that currently get more aid than their unmet need under the formula. And I'm sure if we need to go deeper than that, we have staff here that can explain that much better than I can. The second thing that it does is increases the appropriation to local government aid for 2015 and 2016. And I have some testifiers here today that will tell you why this is important. But essentially, I see this as important for a couple of reasons. One, by increasing it by this $57 million, we will essentially bring LGA back to what it was in 2002. And we all know that we've seen repeated reductions and cuts to that program since then, with the exception of last year when we increased it by $80 million new dollars, which went a long way, much appreciated by cities all across Minnesota. But this particular provision would bring us back to where we were in 2002. It will help cities stabilize their budgeting for 2015 and into 2016. And frankly, I think it's one of the best property tax relief programs that we have. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my comments and I'll turn it over to the first testifier.
Thank you very much, Representative Simonson. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bradley Peterson. I'm with the law firm of Flaherty and Hood here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, 85 cities across Greater Minnesota. First off, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for having this hearing today, and Representative Simonson for carrying this bill. You know, our belief is that the reforms and the increased funding in 2013 was a success. I think that it did a lot to stabilize what was a program under siege and whose cracks and age was showing, and also did a lot to provide confidence to local government in terms of their ability to plan into the future. And so I just want to say again that I think the steps that were taken in last year's tax bill were pretty significant. It's also been a success in two other ways. One, in that it has helped restrain property taxes. If you look at levies over the last 25 years, the increase for cities at 1.6% is the third lowest in that 25 years. Levies are also, for last year, or for 2014, are half the yearly average of the last 10 years, being 5.3%. And so significant steps in terms of restraining property taxes. And if you look at people's actual property taxes, especially residents and businesses across the state, many of them are going down. Now, obviously, that depends on where you live and the kind of property that you have in your taxing jurisdictions, but many businesses, many residents are seeing lower taxes, and that's a good thing. Also, an important part of the equation is the fact that communities are being able to reinvest in strengthening their infrastructure and services. Over the last 10 years, the things that cities cut most uniformly across the board were roads and wages. The things that they are reinvesting in with the new LGA dollars are roads and wages. There's a direct correlation between what they had to defer during the Great Recession and to what they are now beginning to catch up on this year. For example, in the city of Staples, where they have a flat levy for 2014, LGA allowed them to look at a 3% increase for their city employees after being frozen for two out of the three last years, as well as to add an additional police officer to ensure that they could get good 24-hour coverage for their city. They had been cobbling together on part-time and overtime, but they've been able to now rehire a police officer to actually do these things, all while maintaining a flat levy from 2013 to 2014. And Mr. Nasby from the City of Windham will talk about their experience as well. As shown by the recent Minnesota City Finances report from the state auditor, the period from 2003 to 2012, both city revenues and expenditures on an inflation-adjusted basis went down, with revenues falling by 9% and expenditures falling by 16%. Cities, both metro and rural, are doing, trying to provide high-quality services and are doing so with many fewer resources. And that's even with the additional $80 million that was added into the formula last year. Cities are still behind where they were at on an inflation-adjusted basis from 2002 when you look at their levy plus their aid. So cities are still playing catch-up. There's stories from across the state of good things that are being done and investments that are being made, but more needs to be done. And so we think that the legislature and the governor really need to capitalize on the success of last year, and you have the resources to do so. You've got a surplus now and into the future, and so if not now, I think there's a good question of when will we be able to get back to 2002. It's a great time to recommit to the program. Momentum is there on our side, and as cities and communities across the state recover from the Great Recession, it's going to be those city services that provide the platform for that recovery. The roads, the infrastructure, the public safety, all of that, the quality of life services like parks, that's going to be the foundation upon which recovery is laid. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'd actually like to introduce Mr. Steve Nasby, who's the city administrator for the City of Windham, to talk about their particular experience, and then would be happy to take questions afterwards.
Excellent. Mr. Nasby. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Davney. Steve Nasby, City Administrator, City of Windham, Minnesota. I'd like to thank the legislature, first off, for the additional LGA dollars last year. It meant a tremendous amount to our community. What we did with the dollars that you provided us last year, we did a 2013 street project. We did a total reconstruction on 24 blocks. We took out debt to do that, so we're going to use some of the LGA dollars to help retire that debt over time. We were also able to buy a rescue pumper truck for the fire department. That's something, we had a 25-plus-year-old truck that needed to be replaced badly. So we were able to take on that project. And then one of the other projects we took on was a partnership with our school to have a school resource officer. And that's something, with all the school shootings and the tragedies throughout the United States, it was something that the public and the school district and the city worked together on to make happen. Without those dollars, that would have been very difficult. So we'd like to, you know, thank you for those things. For our 2014 budget, we left our levy flat. We had 0% change, and that doesn't factor in new growth. It's the same dollars that were levied in 13 are the same dollars we levied in 14. So our taxpayers did see a rate reduction because we did have a little bit of growth in our communities. So we're able to hold the line on that. In 2012, we had actually had a 3% increase. So you can see we went down to zero. So that was a significant change for us and benefit to the taxpayers. Should any additional resources come into local government aid, some of the things we want to do in our future is we've got a fire hall. Our fire hall is very dated. It's old. We actually have to, the fire truck that we're purchasing, we actually had to make sure we could get a truck to fit into the fire hall. The equipment's gotten bigger, but our fire hall is, dated back from the 50s and 60s. So we have to kind of look at, can we even get it in the door? And then the other item with the fire hall is we have a piece of equipment actually stored at alternate locations. It's not all at one spot. We've got a pumper that's under the water tower, and that's a mile plus away from the fire hall. We've got to do that, and we spread our equipment out, like our grass rig that gets stored away, the water truck gets stored away, the boat gets stored away in the winter. So it's not something we can have all at one location. And we serve 190 sections in three cities. So we've got a fairly large department with 31 firefighters. So it's equipment that we need. It's not something that, we've got excess equipment. We need it all to serve. And then the other things that we're looking at doing, Mr. Peterson had mentioned, you know, wages. I know we've held the line pretty tight on ours the last 6 years with 1% general wage for our employees the last 6 years. There have been some cities that have been settling around us for the next upcoming few years. Laverne settled at a little over 7%. Slayton has settled at 7%. St. James went to arbitration. They were a little over 5%. And those are, you know, 2 and 3 year windows. St. James was a 2 year window, and the other two were threes. So we know that that is coming down the line as our contract expires. And the other thing is roads. You know, you can see that we did a large street project with our money, but when we're looking at doing overlays or seal coats, that's gotten tremendously more expensive for the materials over the years. You used to be able to get bituminous for $50 to $60 a ton. The last project we did several years ago, it was $75, and if you do small projects, it's up over $100 a ton. So that really eliminates, you know, some of the things that we can do. The city's been trying to be proactive on it, and we have actually done a few of our streets in concrete now. Just when you factor in the life cycle costs, it's just a more efficient way of doing it and a little more environmentally friendly, so we're not putting oil down on the seal coat. So we're kind of taking that approach, but all those things do cost money, and you know, the state local partnership is something we count on. Obviously, with the projects we've undertaken, we've incurred some debt, so you know, we're kind of dependent on that state-local partnership to continue forward. So anything you can do to help us out is certainly greatly appreciated. Our representative, Representative Hamilton, is co-author on this bill, and so we'd like to thank Mr. Simonson and Mr. Hamilton for their work on these.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nasby. Questions? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments. In light of the recent VOS database report and so on, we see, it's been, you know, we've seen this in several successive reports, that Greater Minnesota as a percent of income is paying substantially less in property taxes. Anyway, I would just like to say that in the future it would be wonderful to be able to see what a $200,000 home, you know, is paying in each of the cities as we look at their LGA. Because I think that, you know, when you're talking about property taxes rising 10%, and it's only on a, you know, a $500 property tax bill, you know, that's a whole different deal. So we don't have enough data, I think, here to actually compare and contrast, but we keep hearing the same theme that, you know, we've got problems in Greater Minnesota with property taxes, and we really don't. So I would just wish we could, you know, pursue this further.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Nasby at this time? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up comment. The testifier commented on what a resounding success the increase in LGA has been as a result of the last session. And although I would agree with that analysis if you were a city that received LGA, it's important to note that only one in eight cities in the state of Minnesota, or approximately 12%, actually lowered their property taxes as a result of getting more LGA. And seven of eight cities actually increased the levy. So property taxes have not gone down for the vast majority of homeowners.
Mr. Peterson.
Well, yeah, I wanted to respond because I think that, you know, there's a couple issues here, and you know, property tax relief is one goal of local government aid, but it's not the only goal. You know, for 4 decades, it's been the policy of the state of Minnesota that if you live in a certain community, you should be able to have good, high-quality services at a reasonable cost. And so that has been, I think, the magic of local government aid, is that whether you are in Windham or Wayzata, a fire truck costs what a fire truck costs. But if you live in some communities, you have much greater capacity to purchase that without putting as much of a burden on your property taxpayers. And LGA helps those communities that don't have as high a capacity to purchase that fire truck or pay for that cop or whatever the service is. And so while the levy piece of it is one piece, there's the service piece is another. And I would really, you know, caution all members of the committee that as you look at these issues, you really, it's a community by community set of circumstances. And different communities have different needs. They have different circumstances. They have different projects that they're undertaking, and so whether or not the levy goes up, you know, 1% or down 1%, I don't think is really the key point in all of this discussion. I think the key point is, are our communities stronger? Are we providing high quality services across the state at an affordable rate? And are we laying the foundations for continued success?
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I couldn't believe my ears when I heard Representative Rumbeck say that rural Minnesota does not have a property tax concern, or whatever you said. First of all, I want to remind members that ag land went up about 11%, about $62 million in rural Minnesota. And when the market value of homestead credit was cut a few years ago, homeowners' property taxes in rural Minnesota went up 8 times higher than the metro area. Representative Rumbeck, property taxes are a huge concern in rural Minnesota, and I can't believe you said what you said. I think also when we look at some of these BOSS studies, and this may be a little different, but part of it has to do with the education levies. In that, up till last year, 37 school districts in our state had absolutely zero on levies, when the average is about $1,000 per kid. 37 had zero. Every one of those in rural Minnesota. And so the fact that it might have shown a little bit lower on the property taxes is because, for whatever reason, many of these rural school districts haven't been able to raise referendums to try to just cover everyday educational needs, which has caused huge disparity between the high revenue and low revenue in Minnesota. I must say, Mr. Chair, that what happened in the education bill last year actually closed that disparity between the high and low by about 22%. So that was a very positive thing. And then one other factor is that local government aid played a big factor in helping, actually for the first time in a decade, Mr. Chair, reduce property taxes in this state. And it was the total package. You know, a total assault on property taxes, a final enough is enough that we're going to get a hold on this and cut property taxes. And so with the new homestead credit refund, with the local government aid, with the county program aid and township, we're able to do that. And some have said, well, it went down $8 million when you look at everything. Well, in the last 11 years, the average increase with the PTR was an increase of $330 million. That's an average. We went minus eight under the donut hole. That's a difference of $338 million. So the proof is in the pudding here, that not only did what happened in the package of the PTR, homestead credit, and local government aid increase, lower property taxes, but what it also did, maybe two other really important things, reestablished the state and local relationship, which I think had been severed a bit in the last decade, helped strengthen that, but also allowed cities and counties, or local districts that are providing our residents with the most basic and important needs, law enforcement, fire protection, to allow you to get to work after a snowstorm, all of these type of things to improve that. So I guess just to say that there isn't a property tax problem in rural Minnesota, or to say that this didn't in fact cut property taxes, just totally contradicts the record. And so, Representative Simonson, thanks for bringing this forward. And this is local government aid has been very important for rural Minnesota and actually throughout the state. And one thing people don't realize with local government aid, it's really the one real property tax relief we have for businesses. There isn't anything else that really goes directly to businesses. But local government aid helps equalize things between rural areas and other areas of the state when it comes to Main Street businesses. So thank you, Mr. Representative Simonson, for bringing this forward. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. Representative Simonson, do you have other testifiers?
I think there may be, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify regarding House File 2689? Mr. Carlson, good afternoon. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to Thank Representative Simon and others for introducing this bill today that would increase the funding for LGA back up to the 2002 level. The League has had a policy on its books pretty much since 2002 to support the restoration of those cuts. Back in 2002, LGA was funded at $565 million, and this would bring us back up to that level. I want to say that in 2002, total city levies were $1.1 billion. In 2014, total city levies are almost $2 billion, and LGA is still currently $57 million below that level. As you can tell, over that decade, or actually 12 years, the pressure on the property tax has increased a lot, and LGA has not even met or has not even maintained itself in terms of its funding level for cities across the state of Minnesota. I do want to also say that in last year's tax bill that included initially included the LGA formula changes, we also included an adjustment that would have reinstituted an automatic adjustment each year for LGA, and the League also has a policy supporting that adjustment to allow the program to grow and to offset future property tax increases. So that is another factor that our city officials wanted to include in our policy positions for this year. Mr. Chair, with that, I guess I would stand for any questions, but we do thank Representative Simon for introducing this important piece of legislation.
Mr. Carlson.
Simon. He's running
for different guy.
My representative.
Check the press, though.
Yeah, there you go. Mr. Carlson, as you represent all the cities of the state, is there a difference in the was there a difference in property tax levies last year between the cities that receive receive LGA and those that do not?
Mr. Chair, are you referring to now the final certified 2014 levy?
Should say yes. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, we did look at the relationship of levy increases to LGA increases because of the tax bill that was enacted last year. Cities that either don't get LGA or had their LGA frozen, and I'm sorry I don't have a count, I think that was about 180 cities between that group. So cities that got no additional funding from LGA had an average levy increase of 2.7% from 2013 to 2014. Cities that received LGA, something above zero, $1 increase or more, had an average levy increase of 1.2%. So less than half of the increase of those cities that did not receive any LGA or did not receive an LGA increase. We think that's fairly convincing evidence that LGA did reduce the levies in those cities for 2014 that did receive LGA increases.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since the testifier chose to compare Wyndham to Wayzata, a community that I represent, and I don't think anybody takes issue even with the arguments that Representative Marquardt made with regard to, the total package, per se, in terms of what happened with property taxes. But it's important to note that when you look at Minnesota's ranking, and this is one of the more favorable rankings that Minnesota has with regard to taxes, is that with regard to property taxes in whole, as the whole tax picture, we rank right in the middle of the pack, even today without the LGA, as being about in the 25th, 26th, 27th, somewhere right in the middle there. So, to Representative Runbeck's defense in terms of the comment made, what she was trying to articulate, I believe, is that a percent increase of a $500 tax bill is a much different number than a percent increase on a $5,000 tax bill. And the reality is, with respect to income, and I've stated this several times in committee, that the Western Hennepin metro area is, as a percent of its income, household income, is paying 5% or more of its income to property taxes. So that's all we're trying to say. And with regard to the distribution of LGA, we continue to have metro communities that fall in this purview where the burden upon household income gets absolutely no LGA. So I'm not advocating that we expand LGA and that the communities get LGA where the burden is the highest. But what I am saying is it appears to me that when you look at the data, rural Minnesota is just more conservative than we are in the metro. And they refuse to pass levies, and they refuse to burden themselves with additional property taxes. And so that's, I think, part of the explanation here. Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 2689?
Yeah, for a closing comment, Mr. Chairman?
Absolutely. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to thank Representative Simonson for coming forward with this bill, because with an increase in the appropriation of almost $56 million a year, LGA will be fully funded. We'll no longer have these long debates about communities coming here and asking for additional assistance and local government aid. This will fully fund it, and we can move on to more pressing issues. Thank you, Mr. Representative Simonson.
Representative Simonson.
You know, I'll just make some closing comments.
Yes.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, for hearing this bill. I know that this is kind of an unusual request for this session, but I just want you to consider as you go forward. We can talk about numbers and property taxes and value, but I do think two points are important to make. One is that these distributions of dollars out to cities are not going to people that irresponsibly spend money. I mean, we're sending these dollars out to city governments, county governments, township governments that are responsible to their voters, and I think it's important to know that they're not spending money irresponsibly. And secondly, I think that as we move forward in time, it's important that the state partner with local governments and provide some sort of stability into the future so that they know what's coming, at least for the next year or two. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Appreciate thank you, Representative Simonson. Excuse me. Thank you, Representative Simonson. Next, we will move to the evaluation report of the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I want to thank you for your patience. Representative Hansen was not available, and we wanted to be able to package the review of the OLA's evaluation with Representative Simon, or excuse me, Representative Hansen's bill. While they are setting up again, thanks to me, Representative Garofalo, would you be so good as to move the Wednesday, March 12th minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Actually, we're going to do the report first, so, and I think they may need both chairs. I'm not sure, Representative Hansen.
It just came from another report. So.
Ah. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and thank you for having us here today. Yes, we just came from releasing another report.
I've heard about it on Twitter.
And Mr. Chairman and members, I think the two reports, although very different in terms of subject matter, I think there is one similarity, and that is government is often criticized for creating programs and organizations and just letting them live on, whether they're effective or not. And I think one of the reasons why you, the legislature, created the Office of the Legislative Auditor and the Legislative Audit Commission is to work against that tendency and to require periodic evaluations to really determine if the programs and organizations that you've created are effective. One of the challenges that we often have, and one of the challenges that you will hear about for the Sustainable Forest Incentive Program, is that we're not completely clear about what it is we are trying to accomplish with that program. And so as we went off to evaluate it, that was one of the challenges. And so we come back to you with a recommendation that you clarify that and that you create goals that ultimately, if we were to go back and do another evaluation, we would be able to measure to see exactly whether this program, which provides certain tax incentives to people, is whether or not we're simply providing the tax incentive and the tax break, so to speak, or are we really accomplishing something that the name of the incentive would imply, and that is helping to create sustainable forests. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would like to introduce Carrie Meyerhoff, who was the manager of the evaluation, and she is going to make a short presentation of our findings and recommendations.
Ms. Meyerhoff, again, thank you for your patience and welcome to the committee. I do find I can't see you. Yes, thank you. That's going to make the rest of the afternoon go so much better.
Okay.
If you would please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Carrie Meyerhoff with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I'd like to start with some background information about the Sustainable Forest Incentive Program before getting to our findings and recommendations. The Sustainable Forest Incentive Program was created in 2001 to address concerns that the legislature had with the taxation of forest land in Minnesota. Kind of came out of a report that the Department of Revenue worked with the Minnesota Forest Resource Council on, and they made several recommendations. And what resulted is a program that is administered by the Department of Revenue. It's funded with an open appropriation from the general fund, and it provides an annual per acre incentive payment to private owners of forest land who are enrolled in the program. Between 2003 and 2013, the state has made $44 million in incentive payments, with the purpose of the program being to encourage a long-term commitment to sustainable forest management among private forest landowners. This slide just shows you that since the inception of the program, participation has increased every year. In 2013, there were approximately 2,300 landowners participating in the program. And I'd like to clarify that landowners can be individuals or they could be businesses or nonprofit organizations. This also shows with the yellow bars that the enrollment of acreage in the program also increased every year until 2011, and then has dropped in the two most recent years. Most of the participants in the program have 160 acres or fewer enrolled in the program. The median ownership is 120 acres. But as you can see, there are about 0.4% of the enrolled participants have enrolled 1,920 acres or more, accounting for almost half of the acres enrolled in the program. And I draw your attention to this line because it is these landowners who are required to provide public access to the land that they've enrolled in the program. And this map just shows it's not very surprising that most of the enrolled acres are in northern Minnesota. There is a map on page 12 of the report that actually shows the acreages in each county that are enrolled in the Sustainable Forest Incentive Program. So I wanted to go over the requirements to participate in the program. People who are interested must enroll at least 20 contiguous acres of land. At least half of that land must be forested. In addition, they must have a forest management plan that covers those acres. The plan has to have been written in the previous 10 years by a plan writer that's been approved by the Department of Natural Resources. And these plans lay out the landowner's objectives for their forest land and include activities that would help the landowner achieve those objectives. Activities in the program, in the plan, must be consistent with the state's timber harvest and forest management guidelines, and those are guidelines that have been developed under the direction of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. In addition, landowners must record a covenant on their land that restricts development for a minimum of 8 years. If they have enrolled more than 1,920 acres in the program, they must allow public access to their land. And then people interested in enrolling in the program have to apply. And I mention that because at that point, the Department of Revenue, you know, verifies that they are the owner of the property, that they're current with their property taxes, and that they meet other requirements of participation. And then annually, the landowners must attest to the fact that they continue to meet the program requirements and be eligible for the per acre payment. Currently, the per acre payment is $7 per acre. So tracing the program from really when it started back in 2001 to the present day, we identified four goals of the program. One was to provide some type of property tax relief to owners of forest land, private owners of forest land. Another was to encourage a commitment to sustainable forestry by those landowners. A third goal was to prevent parcelization and development of forest land. And, you know, parcelization is when you divide the ownership up among multiple owners, and that can lead to management difficulties if you're trying to manage sustainably for the forest resources. And finally, to secure public access to large tracts of private land. So those are really the four goals that we were trying to measure the program against. And we looked at the way the program is designed and administered to see how it relates to these goals. So first we found that the incentive payment is not tied to property taxes, and it's not tied to any of the goals I just went through. It's $7 per acre regardless of the property taxes an individual is paying on their property, regardless of the activities they undertake on their property, regardless of whether or not they have to provide public access. When we compare the property tax payments of a small number of participants with the incentive payments that they received, we found that there was a great difference in the extent to which the payments offset property taxes of those participating landowners. And it ranged from a low of around, I think it was 12%, to over 200% of their property taxes. So in other words, in some part of the state, people are paying $3 per acre for their forest land in property taxes, and they're receiving an incentive payment of $7 per acre. We also found that the effect of the covenant on preventing parcelization and development is unclear. You know, in theory, having a covenant on property, a covenant that restricts development, might make that property unattractive to a potential buyer. But there is nothing in the act or in the covenant that prevents a participant from selling their land, from parcelizing it and selling it to other people. And county assessors have found actual or potential violations on land that is enrolled in the program. In other words, people have built a house or a cabin or something on land that's enrolled in the program. Now, to be fair, there are few confirmed violations.
Can I ask a question to that one?
Certainly, Representative Mahoney. Thank you, Ms. Myro. Mm-hmm.
When the county assessor has found actual and potential violations, including new structures and development, what do you have any idea what happened to those structures or that development? Was it removed, or was it just, we're sorry we bothered you?
Ms. Meyerhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney. It's my understanding that there have been no consequences to people who have violated the covenant. I'm aware of only one instance in which a participant was penalized and removed from the program, and that was someone who converted forest land to pasture. But otherwise, there have not been penalties.
Representative Hart?
I think that deserves a little bit more digging into to find out who, what, and where, but not for right now.
Ms. Meyerhoff, continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So while there have been few confirmed violations, we suspect that the actual number of violations might be higher because there is very little oversight required in the Sustainable Forest Incentive Program. I mentioned the annual attestation that participants must make each year that they are continuing to comply with program requirements, and that is really the only required oversight in the program. The Department of Revenue has reached out to county assessors and asked for their assistance in checking to see if participants are complying with program requirements, and has received varying responses in terms of how much checking those county assessors actually do. And also the forest management plans that are submitted when people enroll in the program are not reviewed by the Department of Natural Resources or anybody to make sure that they are meeting the requirements in the law and that the actions in the plans are consistent with sustainable forestry. We also found that the Act does not adequately address the issues that are raised by subsequent owners of enrolled land. So as I mentioned, the covenant right now does not prevent an enrolled landowner from selling their land. Well, the Department of Revenue might not know who the new landowners are. They might not know who to be following up with every year to make sure that they are continuing to meet with program requirements. Because even when an owner sells the land, the covenant that prevents development, or is supposed to prevent development, travels with the land. If new owners do not apply to the program, there's then no oversight. They don't do the annual attestation, and the property is not included on the list that is sent to county assessors, asking that they also check for compliance with the program requirements. And finally, subsequent owners who do apply to the program are not required to meet the same eligibility criteria as new applicants to the program. There is not a process by which the department confirms that the land is actually forest land, and they are not required to get a forest management plan for their acreage. And finally, we concluded that the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act penalty provision is too limited. Right now, it is based on the incentive payments that a participant has received in the previous 4 years, so they might have to repay up to 4 years of their payments. But a violator might not have received payments. So some of the violations that have been found on land were by subsequent owners who never enrolled in the program, so they never received a payment. It also does not differentiate among violations. There might be some that would be considered more serious than others, but it's the same penalty provision regardless of the violation that the participant commits. And finally, it can include removal from the program, and depending on what the violation is, that might not be in the best interests of the goals of the program. For example, if somebody has just not carried out a forest management activity in the best way, it might be better to work with that person to help them better manage their forest land than to kick them out of the program. And so we had several recommendations that derive right from those findings that we made. First, we think that the incentive payment that is made through this program should either be tied more explicitly to the program goals, or that the legislature should repeal the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act and try to achieve the goals of the act through other mechanisms and other programs. So to be clear, we're not saying that they're not good goals. We're just saying this might not be the best way to target them. We think that the forest management plans that are required of this program should be registered with the Department of Natural Resources, who then could do some kind of review to make sure that they're consistent with requirements. We think there needs to be increased verification of the compliance with the program requirements to make sure that the people who are receiving this annual per acre incentive payment are continuing to comply with the program requirements. Clarify and expand the penalty provisions, and to amend the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act to better address issues of subsequent owners. And as I read that last one, I'm realizing if you repeal the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, the rest of those don't really matter. But if you do keep the act, these are some things that we think need to be addressed. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you very much, Ms. Meyerhoff.
Yeah.
Questions from members? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only comment about enforcement with regard to development, my experience in most of rural counties where I've developed or built something, you're dealing with the County Planning and Zoning Board, and I can't imagine it would be that difficult to have a database that has PID numbers that somebody would check before they issue a building permit, provided the applicant gets a building permit. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hansen. The chair will move House File 2782 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus report. Representative Hansen, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I apologize for being late. It was with Mr. Nobles upstairs, and it'll be interesting to see what the Twitter account was for that. But, you just heard a very sobering report that essentially said, here is a program that is broken. You either mend it or end it. House File 2782 ends it. It's that simple. I want to just highlight one particular thing because it's a property tax issue. The auditor's report said that there are Minnesotans who pay maybe $2 or $3 per acre on property tax, and they are getting a check from the general fund from everybody in this room, and they're all of our constituents, for $7. They're paying $2 or $3, and they're getting a check for $7. That alone is enough to repeal this program, in my view. Now, you're going to hear from a wide variety of people who are going to support the status quo or mending the status quo. I would ask that you pass the bill on to the next level in your report, because I think this conversation has to continue. And frankly, if we look at the mending effort on this, it will not happen without the threat of ending the bill.
Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify regarding House File 2782?
Mr. Chair?
Oh, sorry, Representative Mahoney.
Representative Hanson.
Certainly, of course.
Has anyone given you an idea of what the cost of all this regulation and enforcement of the regulations that were spoken to by the auditor? Looks like you have to have people driving around 300,000 acres across two-thirds of the state.
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney, and in the full audit, I'd encourage you to look at the full audit report. It defines kind of, there's two different places where there's cost. The state government cost is relatively limited because it's sending out a check. That's what's happening. And there's not a feedback loop to that revenue department sending out a check. So it's the cost of sending out a check. The status quo is there's not much cost occurring right now with the status quo. I think looking at the various proposals to provide more enforcement, you'd have to have local government involvement. You'd have more contact at local government, and you'd have to have that mechanism of the local government connecting with the state government on requiring that the payment is modified.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Wouldn't you also need the DNR with its... Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Noble is kind of doing his best imitation of me and my ADHD.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Again, Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor, Representative Mahoney, I think you ask the really essential question here. How is this program monitored or overseen at all by DNR? And Ms. Meyerhoff mentioned one way in which it is not, but you bring up another way in which it is not. And if the department were more attentive to this program, which after all, it seems by its very name, would clearly be an interest of a program of interest to the department, you could achieve what was just suggested, more oversight, by having the DNR conservation officers and other employees of DNR who are already driving all around the state of Minnesota in a variety of other capacities. If they were aware, for example, that we are now driving by a piece of property that is in this program and development is not supposed to occur, and they see development occurring, that would be another set of eyes that was already there with no added cost to be aware that something needs to be done. So I think the main point here is that, and this was, I think, quite a surprise to me, again, given the name of this program and what we're trying to achieve, is how little involved DNR has been with this program. It's really been considered more a tax program. And even the jurisdiction of where the program originated was in the Senate Tax Committee with almost virtually no involvement of oversight from Natural Resource Committees.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm not surprised that something was in the Senate Tax Bill. Noticed, but you said that there would be almost no new cost to the DNR. I want to finish. I mean, I so respect every opinion I've gotten from you, but not that one, because I know our every time we add one more thing to our state employees to have to do, whether it's drive by and, oh, yeah, I got to write that down, or a new program, and the department comes in and says they can absorb that. Apparently, the department heads don't ever listen to their employees, because their employees call me and say, you know, I'm working 60 hours for 40 hours worth of pay, and I can't wait for the overtime hours to get changed. But, you know, that's just an editorial comment, and I'll leave it at that.
Any further discussion on House File 2782? Senator Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen, you know, one of the one of the things mentioned here is that, in fact, if this program is repealed, then maybe there should be looking at something else. I mean, do you think the state has an interest in sustainable forest management? Do you think there should be a replacement, or you think, I mean, just your thoughts on that from your area of expertise, so to speak.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt, as a state, we have a number of tools that we use to achieve sustainable forestry. There's a sustainable forestry certification so that the market helps move towards practices that encourage a sustainable forest. In addition, we have the conservation easement programs that are there, where we purchase certain development rights to achieve that. I believe there is a role for some property tax type of incentive, something that encourages, and I would focus it, and maybe this is just more the populist in me, but I would focus it on the private landowners, not the corporations and not the nonprofits. I think parcelization and preventing parcelization is something when you look at large tract land ownership. But we have, as a state, have invested in large conservation easements to prevent parcelization. Where the tool, I think, is needed is particularly for new landowners who are buying those parcels in some areas, about how to manage their woodlot sustainably. They may be 40 acres, 80 acres, 120 acres. This may be their retirement home, and they're looking at how do we do that. I think the conservation easements we've done with some of the large corporations is a tool that can be used there, and we shouldn't be layering those tools, that we should be using them kind of enhancing each other, not together. That's just my personal opinion based on, I know there's others that disagree, but I think the individual responsibility of a landowner, small tract, is important.
Thank you.
Okay, I do see that we do have a couple testifiers from the audience who would like to come up. certainly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Zumbauen, Chair of the Government Relations Committee with Minnesota Forestry Association, Minnesota's oldest organization of conservation, founded in 1876 to promote stewardship of Minnesota's forests. Over time, our mission has evolved to focus on family-owned woodlands, which are under the most threatened by development due to higher real estate values and property taxes, and where many landowners lack information on forest management. We pursue our mission through educational programs and advocacy with the goal of encouraging the retention and sustainable management of family-owned woodlands. The Sustainable Forest Incentives Act, or SFIA, along with the 2C managed forest property classification, are very important in supporting that goal. And I speak for the nearly 2,300 small woodland owners who are managing their property under a management plan that they voluntarily obtained and have recorded a covenant intended to protect those woodlands from development. Without the SFIA annual payment, a number of owners have told me they would likely have sold their lands. We are also concerned that without the SFIA, the larger ownerships may find it financially to their advantage to sell their lands, which could result in some of those forests being turned to other purposes, such as a potato field, causing some cabin sites to be built in the midst of a relatively undisturbed forest that could have impact on wildlife habitat and water quality, let alone seeing new roads built to access those properties by the new owners. That said, we think the auditor's report is a fair assessment of the SFIA. Frankly, our organization was aware of many problems with the SFIA prior to the auditor's report. As a matter of fact, we welcome the auditor's evaluation, hoping it would bolster our efforts to address a number of the same issues that we had identified, that the auditor also identified, that we tried to pursue in the 2011 legislative session with House File 1121, that a bill crafted by Minnesota Forestry Association but was not heard in committee. Recently, Representative Bill and Senator Saxhog requested the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Revenue, and the Minnesota Forest Resources Council to convene a stakeholder group to address the legislative auditor's report and come forth with recommendations on the SFIA. We strongly support that effort. I would like to conclude my remarks with a plea. Please don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Despite its problems, the SFIA is still a good tool for encouraging sustainable forest management. Please let the Forest Resource Council's group come forth with their recommendations on the SFIA. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Is it Umbaland?
Zumbalan.
Zumbalan, pardon me. Can you respond to what were your suggestions in, or your, what was in House File 1121 in 2011? What recommendations do you have for changing SFIA?
Well, one of them was to register the plans with the Department of Natural Resources that are not now required. Another was strengthen disclosure requirements to prospective buyers of properties enrolled under the SFIA. The fact of the matter is, in relation to Representative Mahoney's question, we were aware of a number of those violations with structures being built on properties, but I want to point out that many of these violations occurred on properties that were purchased by individuals who didn't have a management plan. They bought lands that were under an existing covenant by someone else. The vast majority of the woodland owners that have obtained a management plan by themselves and recorded the easement, that's not much of a problem. So we had enhanced disclosure requirements. We also recommended increasing the penalty for non-compliance with the covenant, as an example. Those were some of the major features. And also we addressed the transfer of ownership, enhancing that responsibility for the landowners and the Department of Revenue. We've come forth with additional recommendations as a result of the legislative auditor's report that we're going to be providing to that stakeholders group that the council has convened.
One last question, Mr. Zumbalan. How do you respond to the point that I think Representative Hansen made and others that some people are getting SFIA payments greater than their property tax liability on the land?
That certainly wasn't the Mr. No, Chairman, I'm sorry.
Quite all right.
That certainly wasn't the intent of the SFIA. Quite frankly, we tried to address that in the 2011 session, pointing out that the payment structure was unsustainable. At that time, the budget deficit that the legislature was looking at was, what, $5, $6 billion? We felt that that's unsustainable. It certainly was a unforeseen consequence of what the Department of Revenue had done with changing the 2B timberland and tying it to the 2C managed forest law that is based on the values of properties that enter that program, which tended to drive the incentive payment to more than $15 an acre. We were aware of that. The Department of Revenue informed us that that issue, and you know, this has completely blindsided us. We do recommend in our current committee's recommendations that the payment not exceed $7 per acre under the current law and tie it to the average value of lands, the rural vacant classification. not to exceed that in those counties. That would be our recommendation.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for the testifier from members? Thank you very much, sir. Other individuals wishing to testify? Mr. Zameda, come on up. Sir, we'll get to you next. Good afternoon. Please identify yourself for the
table. Good afternoon. Representative Dabney, other members of the committee. My name is Dave Zameda. I serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. The council is created by the Sustainable Forest Resources Act of 1995. The core mission of the council is to advise the governor and legislature as well as public agencies on sustainable forest policies and practices. Council consists of 17 members, a very diverse array of members, including Forrest Bow, who's the director of the Division of Forestry, who's in the audience and represents the Department of Natural Resources on the council. I've been asked to testify on House File 2782 on behalf of both the DNR and the council. Because of my role with the stakeholders group that Mr. Zambalin was just referencing, that we recently co-convened with along with DNR and the Department of Revenue, and the council's extensive involvement with policy issues like this in years past. In both 2011 and 2013, my council delivered legislatively mandated reports that included recommendations for revising and improving the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. The 2013 report was referenced in the recent Legislative Auditor's Report on the Sustainable Forest Incentive Program, as are a number of other council documents and programs you'll see in the footnotes throughout the report. In late December 2013, DNR Commissioner Landwehr, Revenue Commissioner Franz, and I received a letter from Representative Dill and Senator Saxhog asking us to convene a stakeholder group to discuss the issues raised and the recommendations outlined in the Legislative Auditor's Report. All of you should have received a copy of that letter. It's in your packet there, as well as a copy of our February 24th letter that responded to the legislator's request. On the back of the December 20th letter, there's a list of who the stakeholders were that were involved in this group, and you see there quite a diverse array of stakeholders, including a legislative auditor, legislative assessor, county assessor from Aitkin County, among quite a few others. Senator Saxon and Representative Dill asked the group to consider how the legislature could clarify the goals of SFIA incentive payments and to consider how to improve the connections between SFIA payments and the program goals and tax amounts, as had been recommended by the Legislative Auditor's Report. On February 12, the Department of Revenue, the DNR, and my council co-convened this diverse group of stakeholders to talk about the report and the other program issues. Most of the stakeholders generally agreed with the report's recommendations. While most believe the findings and recommendations related to strengthening program oversight and could be addressed in a short term, many suggested changes to the structure of incentives would require more time and analysis. They intersect with other broader policy issues that require some careful deliberation before the SFIA is eliminated without being replaced in a thoughtful way. The Council intends to continue meeting with these stakeholders as part of a global competitiveness study of Minnesota's forest products industry that was recently initiated by DNR Commissioner Landwehr. This group is, in part, investigating larger questions about the goals for sustaining Minnesota's forest land. This study will likely supplement the auditor's finding and yield additional insight into what, if any, changes should be made in SFIA payment structure, the interplay of tax policy, incentives, and other mechanisms to ensure sustainable management of private forest lands. Commissioner set a study deadline of December 1, 2014, with recommendations to be sent back to him. The DNR and Council's position on House File 2782 is as follows. The Council and DNR are broadly supportive of the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act because of the many economic and environmental benefits it provides to the state and its citizens. SFIA encourages private landowners to retain forest land and conduct long-term forest management activities that provide an important source of fiber for Minnesota's forest products industry. In terms of environmental benefits, SFIA discourages forest parcelization development and habitat fragmentation while providing a host of environmental services, for example, wildlife habitat and water quality protection, carbon sequestration, renewable energy supplies, and public access for diverse outdoor recreational activities, including hunting and fishing on these larger tracts of forest land. I want to be clear, DNR and the Council, the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, generally concur with the auditor's findings and recommendations. DNR and MFRC recognize that changes are needed within the SFIA to more adequately link SFIA forest management goals to the incentive payments provided. There's also a need to address the issue that Representative Hansen raised about some folks getting more in payments back from the Department of Revenue than they were due in taxes, and we agree that that needs to get changed. Council intends to continue meeting with this diverse stakeholder group, including the DNR and the Department of Revenue, to discuss the issues raised within the auditor's report. The group intends to consider the goals of the SFIA program and develop recommendations as to how the legislature could clarify the goals and more explicitly tie those goals to incentive payments. Both the department and the council suggest deferring large structural changes to the SFIA until the 2015 legislative session, when these recommendations have been developed. The Department and the Forest Resources Council support, in the interim, minor structural changes to the program, potentially including requiring program applicants to register forest management plans with the DNR and clarifying and expanding penalty options for non-compliance with the Sustainable Forest Incentives Act. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Zameda? Representative Mahoney.
Just so you understand where I'm coming from, I've heard a report come out that requires careful and deliberative conversations about its recommendations, and with a requirement that it come, that those recommendations are brought back to a chair or somebody at a time certain. Mm-hmm. And most of those time certains are within 9 months to 18 months. And some of those reports, I got the second or third year I was here, and I still haven't seen the reports, or the recommendations. I'm not impressed when someone says I'm coming back with recommendations 6 months or 9 months or a year later. I've learned here not to trust that particular statement. Not that I don't think you mean to. So maybe this is for Representative Hansen. Maybe you change your bill to eliminate this program unless those recommendations are brought back and acted upon by date certain. Say, I think it was December 1st of 2014, and it's eliminated. Boom, if they're not enacted by the end of session the next year, because frankly, more often than not, these reports and these recommendations just get pushed out and pushed out. And I suspect you've seen that in education and everything else. So frankly, we're talking to people that are a bit more jaded about these reports and the promise of recommendations than you might understand.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a question in your recommendations in the interim. You said to monitor non-compliance. And with the earlier testimony, how would that be done? How would the state, in your mind, monitor after the registration to make sure there is compliance?
Mr. Zameda.
Representative, my understanding is the Department of Natural Resources is willing to undertake that kind of registration very soon, and might be able to do that, without legislation being passed. And I'd if I'm incorrect, refer to Forrest Bow back here, but that's my understanding from the DNR Commissioner's Office.
Mr. Chairman, I understood that you were talking about basically two levels there. Registration was one, and monitoring for compliance. So they can undertake registration.
That's
what
correct.
You're saying, but there was the issue that was raised later, earlier, about compliance, and how do you know then after they've registered that they are complying with the law?
Mr. Zameda.
Representative, my understanding is that the compliance component of it would require some staff time and some additional commitment on the part of the department to do that. That might entail some expense, and that is referenced in the legislative auditor's report. As a result of that, given the governor's interest this year, and I got to clarify, we're first and foremost an executive council, 16 of my 17 members appointed by the governor. We would suggest that kind of a change be deferred till the 2015 session, that being a budget session.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, you did say in your testimony you were speaking for the department as well.
That's correct.
I think at some point on that particular question, how compliance would be monitored, I'd like to hear directly from the department. I understood your comments to be that those were two steps that could take place during the interim. I wasn't interpreting that then as meaning the next legislative session, but maybe if not today, we can hear directly from the department in terms of how the compliance issue would be handled. It requires more staffing. Could they do that with their current staffing levels? The auditor made some suggestions. I know Representative Mahoney took some exception to that in terms of workload. We do frequently sometimes ask departments to do certain activities out of hide, so to speak, and it's always a judgment call as to what they can really accomplish with current staffing and what have you. But I think at some point, if we are going to make those interim steps, we need to know what's going to happen from the department perspective with monitoring the compliance.
Sure. Mr. Bow, do you want to come forward? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Forrest Bow. I'm the Director of Forestry with the Department of Natural Resources. Representative Carlson, your question about monitoring, those are two, I think, what the legislative auditor called steps that could be done fairly soon. Registering the plans with the DNR, I believe, would be a fairly low-cost initiative, and we could start to do that just about any time. The follow-up on compliance is a much bigger issue. As you heard today, there's roughly 2,300 plus of these particular people that are involved in this program. We would want to set up a system whereby those lands would get monitored maybe every 3 years. You'd have to have a considerable number of staff and effort going into that to monitor those lands. You'd have to know where the property boundaries are. There'd be a lot of things to have that system set up at this point.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, what comes to mind with the comments, of course, this is the tax committee, and we don't audit every tax return every year or even very often, but once the word is out there that there are compliance checks, you might not have to do every piece of property, but just there would be an understanding. I'm sure that would probably spread relatively fast. The DNR does monitor for compliance, and who knows who might be up next, and so therefore you'd probably want to comply, my guess. But not everybody accurately fills out their tax returns either, I'm sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney and then Representative Loeffler. Oh, Representative Loeffler. Such a gentleman.
It's such a small. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I was wondering if Mr. Zameda could address the issue that was raised earlier of whether or not this is really an incentive for owners of small woodlots who might have picked up, you know, 40, 80 acres associated with a property that they might even live on, to learn about and sustainably maintain their forests for the benefit of the environment, as being different and having a stronger potential impact on our goals, as opposed to, you know, a large industrial kind of forestry group that manages thousands of acres and has already a market incentive to look at sustainable forestry practices.
Mr. Zemeta.
Representative Loeffler, I'm referring to page 10 of the auditor's report. Shows in 2012 there were 239 participants receiving payments. In 2012, 9 of those had over 1,920 acres. So that means there were 230 that were the family forest owners of the sort that you're referencing, small acreage owners of forest land. So the vast majority of the participants are family forest owners in terms of numbers.
And Mr. Zemeta, is your experience that most of those are people who are doing it as a commercial operation, or is it as a, you know, they might every 10 years want to thin out their woods and they want to make sure they're doing it responsibly, that they're not really into it as an active farmer of trees, as it were?
Representative Loeffler, while we haven't done analysis of these particular 230 owners, other surveys have shown that most private forest landowners manage their land for wildlife or recreation. It might be for hunting, habitat, for birding, other forms of outdoor recreation, trail use, snowmobiling, you know, so on. And that timber harvest is at most a secondary and usually a tertiary concern that they have. You know, they're not primarily owning the land to provide, you know, timber for forest products industry. Though most owners eventually do harvest their land, you know, to achieve other goals. You know, for example, deer habitat improvement. Mm-hmm.
Thank
you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney. Oh. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to kind of chime in a little bit just on some reflections on what we've heard. In a recent property tax committee hearing, I made comments about there was, when we were having the discussion about eliminating some of the property tax classifications, about some of the unintended consequences of our policies, which encourage parcelization or breaking up the land, changing the shorelines of lakes, you know, that there's pressures to do that. So clearly, I think, you know, part of the public policy goal is to prevent parcelization of the forest lands, and that certainly has benefits to the public with regard to the environment and other runoffs. And, of course, when you have parcelization, as mentioned in testimony, you create new roads and other complications of that. We also heard that the violations, although did exist, that they, you know, weren't many. And oftentimes in the real estate world, these larger parcels of land oftentimes are sold or conveyed in non-conventional financing formats. The mechanism often is contract for deeds or purchase money mortgage. In the case of purchase money mortgage, that basically means that the vendor, the seller, is carrying the paper on it and actually granting a mortgage. In the case of a contract for deed, the fee ownership of the property doesn't change until you fulfill the obligations of the contract. In the latter, in the case of contract for deed, oftentimes title work isn't done, so a recorded covenant may not be discovered, and there would be the potential of a vendee would unknowingly violate you know, the circumstances of that covenant. So I think, you know, the violations in terms of their magnitude may be the exception rather than the norm. And lastly, as a property owner of parcels scattered around the outstate area, I do not personally own any properties that only pay $3 an acre for a property tax, so I suspect that might be more the exception than the norm as well. Those are just some of the things to consider, and with regard to the program, rather than a complete elimination, I certainly favor the recommendations of the auditor to look at ways to fix it rather than to end it.
Thank you very much. Others in the audience, please, sir. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Steve Nelson. I'm a private consulting forester from Mora, Minnesota.
Go ahead. Proceed.
Just as a side item, in the last 2 weeks, the timber sale I've been working on has delivered 150 truckloads to St. Paul, and your heat and light are coming from our wood chips. So,
thank you.
One of the big problems I had with SFIA and 2C tax laws was forest health, because I'm a oak wilt disease specialist, and I deal with a lot of private landowners that have oak wilt disease. And a logger asked me last week, when I was telling him and his crew how they're going to treat the oak wilt on the land where these wood chips are coming from. He asked me, he says, what do you do if your neighboring landowner has oak wilt and he's not doing anything about it? And I told him the only way you can make that landowner control their oak wilt, take care of that problem, manage their forest, is change the tax law. Because right now, SFIA, 2C, you can have oak wilt, you can have other diseases threatening your forest, and you can still qualify. So that's the biggest problem I have with the tax law. And also the baseline information that the DNR uses to identify upland ecosystems is old, out of date, inaccurate. There's public agencies managing forests as if they were savannas, and they're getting oak wilt out of that. And us oak wilt foresters end up playing whack-a-mole all the time. We can't keep up with the oak wilt spread from public lands. It goes on to private lands. And I have several suggestions on how to make an enlightened tax law where you can have a competitive tax rate, so you won't have forested lands being clear-cut and stumps pulled and turned into potato farms. They're doing that because of the tax rate, not because they want to make more money growing potatoes. It's because of the tax rate. But I'm faced every summer with disease problems, and I can't see with the tax rates and conservation easements any sense that they want to protect the land with these conservation easements or tax laws. There's nothing in there. I mean, conservation easements deal with building on land, but I could go on for 2 days about the last year and a half I've been helping a landowner defend himself in a lawsuit from Minnesota Land Trust. I put in 250 hours because of the conservation easements so that don't protect land. And so, anyways, I got off on that one. But
it never happens around here.
You should run for office. Then
find out what district he's in.
Is that Farmington?
Tell him to get in line.
Mr. Faust is aware of this. I emailed him last year, and I gave him a blunt second email, so he kind of knows I'm
a clear communicator.
And he's been sending me emails, and I encouraged him to come to testify. Okay. He actually does have some very detailed pie charts and proposals that I would encourage the committee to look at.
All right.
That he's been sending. I mean, it's very well thought out on this issue, and I think oftentimes we have what's it, Representative Anzel calls the professional meeting attenders and the lobbyists mm-hmm. and the suits that the private. But here's a Minnesotan who just contacted us and came forward and I and has done some work and I'd like him to be considered.
And you've got his materials, Representative yeah. Hansen. All right. Thank you. Mr. Nelson.
I was telling him about, Mr. Chair, I was telling him the other day about the baseline information problem, about landowners wanting to manage their forests as savannas or vice versa, or wanting to turn their forests into prairies and it doesn't work out, but they're getting government money or a lower tax rate to do it. The pie charts that I sent them are for most of the counties in the state, and you can find those on Wikipedia. And I prepared those while I was preparing my book that I wrote in 2011 called Savannah Soils of Minnesota. It's a handbook and field guide. Because there is such a problem with people getting bad information from government agencies about how they can convert their land into a savanna, and the result is disease spread. And then I show up, and I have to play whack-a-mole. So that's why I was inspired to write a book in 2011. The other, I had just a couple other comments.
Certainly.
If, or hopefully when they do an enlightened tax law, if they can wrap 2C, SFIA, and all conservation easements into one sensible, common sense tax law, they have to get a competitive tax rate. Probably the reason why they had the $7 per acre in there was they knew that they couldn't compete with ag. The ag, which is number one in the state, wouldn't allow the forestry people to get that tax rate down there to be competitive with ag. It just wasn't going to happen. And I used to be the staff forester with Minnesota Forestry Association back in the 1990s, 93 to 97. And some of those board members during the 90s kept me up to date on how this process was going and developing the SFIA, made in 2001. And basically they said the process got so bad that the representative for small woodland owners, 40% of Minnesota's woodlands, was ignored. And that's why you don't see, as Representative Loeffler asked a few minutes ago, what about the small woodland owners? Well, 40% of Minnesota's woodlands, the largest share of ownership, was ignored. That's how this was created. So you had environmentalists, you had timber industry people, and they got the final say in making, crafting this SFIA. So obviously, you have to have some kind of compliance because there hasn't been compliance, and that's come up a lot of times here. I mean, how can you give someone an incentive payment if you don't know if they're managing their forest? So I've been a tree inspector. I'm a master logger auditor. Both of those programs have annual refreshers. So if you have compliance foresters or natural resource professionals doing compliance, you can have annual refreshers, and they can do like county assessors and do five-year checks. Because a lot of forests are managed on 15-year rotations. They'll go into the woods, you know, once every 15 years. Some people say every 20 years, but 15 years. So within a 15-year period, you could have three or four checks on the property to make sure that it's being managed and there's no diseases, and we'll have healthier forests and more productive forests for the forestry community, the biomass community. I saw something in the DNR newsletter about Senator Saxhog has got this biofuels consortium or something like that. So both the ag and the forestry sectors would benefit from an enlightened tax law, wrapping in the conservation easements also.
All right. Mr. Nelson, anything else?
That should do it.
Thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you.
Others in the audience who wish to testify? Good afternoon. Please welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries and Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Minnesota Forest Industries members are paper mills, engineered wood products manufacturers, sawmills, large forest landowners, many of the acres, in fact, the majority of the acres in SFIA would be with members of mine. We also have members that produce utility poles and renewable electricity from forest biomass. Timber Producers Association members are loggers, truckers, small sawmills, and allied businesses. I also serve on the Forest Resources Council, and Dr. Zemeta previously testified. A little bit of history. Having incentives or encouragement for maintaining forest land and growing trees goes all the way back to our state's original constitution. And I forgot, I thought I had written down what the article and the clause was, but I'm sure you'll just have to trust me on that. There have been a variety of programs through the years. If you look back over the last 65 plus years, we had the Auxiliary Forest Land Law, which was a program through the tax system. It was a contractual program. We had the Tree Growth Tax Law, which was basically a classification program that was optional at each county. And then that was replaced with the SFIA program as an incentive program. There have been reasons why these programs have changed over the years, and as the legislature has chosen to do that for different purposes, and each of them have their kind of pluses and minuses and their approaches, and I'll talk a little bit about that at the end. We have a number of concerns when it comes to the forest land tax system and Representative Hansen's bill, which he and I visited about this morning. First, for us as representing larger forest landowners, but also being highly dependent on the 40% of the forest that's owned by small woodland owners, we need to have a competitive industry. We need to have competitive tax rates for the forest land owners. That's important. Depending upon the comparisons and depending upon what classification or program you may or may not be eligible for, it's highly variable in Minnesota. My members would be very happy if you lifted the cap on of 1,920 acres on 2C. I don't think you're going to do that anytime soon, but that would make us, I think, pretty happy. Might make some of the local property taxpayers quite unhappy as those taxes were shifted. And that's one of the essential problems with this issue, with the forest land being concentrated, in the northern, northeastern part of the state in terms of the percentage of property taxes that we pay. I also have members in southeastern Minnesota. But you have the inevitable shifting, the zero-sum game. That's kind of how we ended up with the SFIA program when it was done, was seeking to, in essence, hold the local taxing districts, which the counties were very vehement about, to hold them harmless. That's how it ended up being as a general fund incentive program as opposed to 2C or the tree growth tax law when it had existed. So competitiveness is important. For the larger landowners, the messages that the legislature sends are important, whether it is bills you pass, bills you consider. It's not a good message to send to repeal this program. I'll just be very frank, for the larger landowners. They're in it as a business activity. They have, owners and people that direct them, and so I think you need to be careful and obviously suspending prospectively, this program, would probably change their thinking about land ownership in Minnesota. And their thinking about land ownership in Minnesota has evolved. It was a year or two ago when there was the state desired some property along the upper Mississippi that one of my members had, and the state wanted to engage in an exchange of that. And they were told, the DNR was told, quite directly that this landowner wanted to own less forest land in Minnesota, not more. primarily because of the tax structure system on the forest land property taxes. I think the we would agree that the legislative auditor did a thorough and good job in reviewing this program. We agree with the bulk of the recommendations that are there in terms of fixing a number of these enforcement and other issues. It's not really an issue for my members. I mean, if you're Bland and Paper Company, Potlatch, Mulpus, with hundreds of thousands of acres, they know where we are. all the companies have staffs that manage these lands and manage these programs. So those kind of things aren't really an issue for us. I think those are more an issue with smaller landowners. If I had one significant criticism of the auditor's report, it would be this. And it was something that I visited on behalf of my organizations with them about, and that is there's really nothing in the report about what are the benefits that the citizens of the state of Minnesota get from this program. That was undertaken. I mean, we spend a fair amount of money, general fund every year, on this program, and what are the benefits? Dr. Zemeta talked about some of them, and one of the primary benefits and one of the benefits that you can monetize is public access to your lands. As part of SFIA, any landowner with more than 1,920 acres has to leave that open for public access for recreation, hunting, bird watching, all of those types of activities if you're in the SFIA program. You can close those lands. Some of those lands have been closed and lease them out to private individuals and cut off the access for the public. That would be a loss of a very significant public benefit that would guess cause a lot of phone calls for various folks. So that would be the criticism that we would have of the auditor's report, of not really enough focus on what the citizens, because that's what you have to evaluate if you're going to recommend a tax expenditure in this area. Is it worth it? Are we getting as a public value that's commensurate with what's being paid? On the topic of paying more than what the property taxes may be, it's a different game if you're providing access. Some of my members have lands where the $7 an acre is more than their property tax payment. If you want to cap them at $3 an acre, and they have to, for their owners, make seven, access is going to be in jeopardy. So I think you need to be mindful of what the actions and reactions may be. Again, and I spoke with Representative Hansen, we are obviously opposed to the repeal of the SFIA program. It certainly would impact access, subdivision, and sales of lands. Going forward, I think there are a number, and Dr. Zemeta kind of talked about one, the effort that's underway through the council and the government agencies. I mean, I think there's a few different directions we as a state can head. We can try and fix SFIA. I think that's a possibility. We can look at doing this through the property tax rate and classification system. You're not going to have a competitive property tax system if you put the large landowners into that, unless you do something to backfill at the local levels. People are going to scream if you put us in 2C. Local property tax owners are going to scream unless something is done to mitigate the impacts on homeowners and commercial industrial property taxes in those systems. We may end up looking at a bifurcated system. I mean, 2C is really a pretty good program. If you're a small landowner, 2C's got a good tax rate. You got to have a plan. You got to have that sent to the DNR and such. It's a pretty good program. But again, I'm not convinced you're going to offer that to us. And offer one of my members the ability to put 250,000 acres in there. I mean, I'm not sure you're going to do that. So, you may end up looking at a bifurcated system. I don't know. Or we might look at something entirely different. Dr. Zemeta and his staff have spent a lot of time on this issue, looking at Wisconsin's system. Well, they have a very low tax rate, but they have a requirement to actually harvest the land, because where a significant amount of the revenue comes from is a severance tax. Well, that's got some pretty big implications for the revenues to the local taxing district. If you have a very low rate over 50 years, and then when the harvesting is done once every 50 years, boom, there's a bunch of money. And how is that going to be spread out within the county or within the state? So it's a complex area. I mean, we appreciate Representative Hansen spurring the debate, the work of the legislative auditor, and look forward to working with all of you and others in the room and outside the room to hopefully find a better system. I've spent a lot of time on this issue in the last 20-plus years. I don't know that we found the silver bullet yet. I don't know that we're going to find the silver bullet, you know, but maybe we can polish some of the tarnish off, whatever the bullet may be. Thank you.
Questions, Mr. Brandt? Representative Mahoney.
I don't know if this is a question for the witness or for the author. Every witness that has come up here has said the benefit of public access. You know, I take my couple of days up north every year, and that's about it. I'm a city kid. So I have no idea what 767,000 acres of land is as a percentage of the land in the state of Minnesota, or the land that's used for hunting, fishing, birding, or whatever. I mean, is it 1% of the land, or is it 10%, or is it 75%?
Mr. Brandt, can you help?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney. Round numbers, 5.5%, something like that. There's, you know, 14.5-15 million acres of forest land in our state, 750,000 acres. But I would also, Mr. Chairman, you know, respond that the acres that are open for access are only the larger tracts. So it would be the acres that my members own and have enrolled.
370,644.
Correct.
So you're talking about
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A substantial tax break for less than 2% of the open forest land and accessible forest land in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Brett?
Mr. Chairman, without doing the arithmetic in my head, I won't.
I'm pretty close on the 2.5%.
All right, I won't challenge that. I would say that one of the things that occurs with the larger tracts is to a greater extent than the individual small tracts. They're in larger blocks, so there's a greater opportunity to access them. And there's also a very long history of people, whether it's folks from the Twin Cities area, folks that grew up north and moved to the Twin Cities areas, going and using those lands for deer hunting, grouse hunting, berry picking, and such, because they've always been open. You know, the industrial lands have always been open for that, and I would guess most people probably figure they're public lands in the first place. So, but I mean, balancing what is paid for what, you know, society gets. I mean, that's the decision that's going to confront you, you know, when you deal with this on an overall basis.
Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if the author has anything to add on that particular point.
Representative Hansen. Well,
and Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we have purchased access through the Outdoor Heritage Fund, spending tens of millions of dollars as well. Some of which has been on land that was already enrolled in SFIA.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
And this will be my last question. I just want to be sure I understood that. So we're paying a $44 million tax break for lands, and not all of it goes to these large tax owners, but some of them are also getting the heritage money, correct?
Representative Hansen?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We are buying conservation easements.
Sounds like a double-dip pension or something.
Mr. Brandt looks like he wants to get involved.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, that's not correct. That is not correct. The tax bill that was passed last year precludes landowners with conservation easements that are greater than, 60,000 acres from getting any payments. So the large easement that was done in and around Itasca County, that landowner is not eligible for SFIA anymore.
Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, clearly anymore, that particular large easement, but we are purchasing forests for the future easements that are smaller than 60,000 acres. So in answering the question, I was answering that there are conservation easements that are being purchased with outdoor heritage funds on SFI land. When you looked at the bar chart that was there, the dip was because the Blandon easement was such a big deal that there's been legislation probably in the last two, maybe 3 years, so that was affecting the total acreage there.
there was caps and then not caps, and we're at the point, again, last year of a change. But to answer the question directly, there are conservation easements being purchased with Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars, less than 60,000 acres currently.
It's a minute, Mr. Chairman, but I'll leave. As you can see, there are things that need fixing in this area of tax law.
Maybe so. Representative Keel, Katie's mom.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question would be is, who's responsible for the approaches and the access to these forest lands if public wants to use them?
Mr. Brandt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, in the instance of my members' lands, you know, we maintain those lands. We maintain the roads where they're on our ownership. There are joint roads due to the intermingled nature of ownership in our state, where there are roads that are, in essence, a section may be owned by by a private company, the next section by St. Louis County, the next section by the DNR. So they're joint in many instances. Also.
Representative Keel?
Thank you. I was kind of curious because that becomes a cost, so to whomever.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 2689? Representative Hansen, closing comments.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity. I would add one particular change that in a stakeholder process, I would offer instead a public process. Often stakeholders by their nature have a stake in the outcome, and if you look at the names and the organizations, it's always an organization based or an entity based thing rather than a public process where the public may be participating. Often the question is with stakeholder processes is where's the role for the public? How do they interact with that? And the stakeholders can go and meet, but where does the public meet and provide input and watch what's happening? So I would encourage any stakeholder process, and perhaps this is a role for some legislative direction if this moves on, is that they have public meetings. I know there's a cost with that, and to involve or incorporate the public somehow into that process so it's not just the stakeholders.
Thank you very much, Representative Hansen.
Thank you.
Next up, Representative Metza, House File 2629. Two things on that, members, and to the public. The committee does not actually have possession of this bill, so this is an informational hearing. Representative Metza does have amendments, but because this is an informational hearing, we'll not be able to act on those amendments today. Mr. Michael? Can you assist us in isolating the provisions of Representative Metz's bill that are germane to the jurisdiction of this committee, please? And I will ask that any questions or testimony regarding House File 2629 limit themselves to the sections germane to the jurisdiction of the committee. Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair... Mr. Chair, sorry, not in full committee again.
It happened yesterday in a different one.
No. Mr. Chair, essentially the tax provisions begin with Section 6, which is the definition of royalty, and essentially run through Section 16 and Section 19. Section 18 is a section that Representative Metz is proposing to drop with his amendment. So it's those provisions that impose this new royalty tax and change the existing distributions of the taconite production tax and create this new Iron Range school construction and improvement trust account that would use taconite production and these royalty tax revenues.
So, Mr. Michael, 6 through 12, Section 6 through 12, is that correct?
16, Mr. Chair.
6
through 16.
6 right. through 16, all right. Thank you very much. Representative Metz, welcome to the committee. I apologize for not having actual possession of the bill at this time, but it did need to come here just the same. So we'll work on it however we may. But if you would please proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And would you like me to give a brief description of the entire bill or just to what the tax changes are?
Let's just focus on the tax changes, if we could.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, again, members. Basically, what we're doing here is moving some of the IRRRB taconite tax revenue within the formulas we currently have in place around a little bit, and we've had a lot of delegation meetings discussing how to create an account that would work well for building a school to enhance the curriculum for our local students, and we've got a little bit of everything in there. I would say the biggest change that we actually make would be reinstating the royalty tax, which was cut out in 1986 and blinked off in 1989 at a 5.5% rate in comparison to when it was shut off. I believe it was 5.75, so we are a quarter of a percent lower. And overall, that's kind of the basics of what it does, and I guess I'll just let you jump right into questions. I know it's Friday, and people are probably looking forward to getting home, especially our rural members. So,
looks like you might have a testifier there, Representative Metza.
Yep.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Cirkvenek. I'm a professional meeting goer for the schools of Virginia, Mount Airy Buell, and Eveleth Gilbert. And so I'm here to help answer any questions on the taconite provisions that are in the bill. And I think it would be appropriate to note, Mr. Chairman, members, that what the provisions do is every year the taconite tax has an escalator that's tied to a national index, the implicit price deflator. And that is, in essence, going up a small percent this year of 3.5 or 3.6 cents out of a total tax of $2.56. And the Representative Metz's bill dedicates that increase to flow into the new Iron Range construction, school construction and improvement trust fund for a number of years, and then dedicates next year's estimated increase as well into that forever, instead of flowing into the normal taconite distributions. In addition, there are several provisions that the legislature earlier has passed that funded school construction in places like Mesaba East and the St. Louis County Schools and Grand Marais. Those bonds are expiring, and the debt payments for those bonds would be put into this new trust account as well. In addition, there's $2.5 million of flow that is remaining at the end of all the taconite distributions, and under current law, it flows two-thirds into the Environmental Protection Fund and one-third into the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Fund. So we're taking $2.5 million from that flow. For example, this year it was $5 million, and that would go into this trust fund as well. In addition to that, to the royalty excise tax, which a little historical background on that tax, it was instituted in 1923 and was in law for 66 years at roughly 6% until 1989. And it's been off the books since then. Royalty holders in Minnesota on taconite mines received $114 million in 2012 of benefits from their royalty holdings, and they paid zero taxes on that in terms of excise tax or income tax. And what this bill does is impose this historical tax back, but dedicates it to school construction. And for members of the committee who may not be that familiar with mining of iron ore, royalties are the underlying minerals that are in the ground, and there's really a couple classes of people who own those. One is the state of Minnesota, and when the industry comes in and says, we pay a lot of money into the Permanent University Trust Fund or to the School Trust Fund, those are the royalty payments that are due to the state under contract. There's a significant amount of money, $114 million out of $161 million in 2012, that flow to private sector royalty holders. And those folks are people like the Great Northern Trust, which is a publicly traded company, the Mesaba Trust, RGGS, the owners of the Boston Red Sox. Common names that you see on the Iron Range, Pillsbury location, Bennett Park. Those are folks, families, who at the turn of the century acquired these minerals, and they, when the taconite is mined, receive so much per ton as reimbursement for their ore that they own, like the state does. And last year in 2012, they derived $114 million worth of income. And I think what the intention of this bill is, those folks who derive so much for so many years, for decades upon decades and generations upon generations, should dedicate some of that revenue back to help rebuild the school system to produce the miners who will mine the ore, who will produce their mineral wealth. And you know, basically every 100 years we ask for a little assistance on building new schools on the Iron Range. So this is that turn in the cycle. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Stefanik. Questions from members? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if anybody's here that can answer this question, and we heard this partly in education finance as well. With regard to the informational sheet on royalty taxes, it gives a brief history of how royalty was assessed a royalty tax, how the minerals were taxed as such. And then it goes on to say that state-owned leases eventually were not subject to the royalty tax, and I would presume that the assumption was the state's interest there was obtaining higher lease rates because they would be discounted by bidders in leasing those things in terms of what the tax consequence would be. So I'm assuming that that was a revenue-neutral issue. In the piece of paper from the Iron Mining Association, it quotes a segment of what is typically in contract language, basically saying that the lessee agrees before penalty attaches for non-payment thereto to pay all taxes, general or specific. And so if you were a landowner and had mineral leases, it would seem to me that that language implies that the mining company would be responsible for the payment on those taxes and not the individual who receives it. The last component of my question is, if the royalty tax was a preferential tax over ordinary income tax, and that royalty tax having been phased out some 25, 30 years ago, is not this income taxable at all as ordinary income on the filer's individual return at the ordinary rate that they're subjected to? Does anybody know the answer to that?
Representative Hertas, you're looking at Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, yes, royalties are a taxable source of income. So, you know, basically, if the individual has a filing requirement, so if they're a non-resident and they have enough Minnesota income to subject them to filing, they would be required to file and report that income and potentially pay tax on it. In some cases, this income may be received by corporations, and if those corporations have no nexus in Minnesota, the state's not going to be able to compel them to essentially file and pay tax on that.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So isn't this really kind of a deference to the equivalent of depletion? I mean, this is compensation of depleting the value of the land because the minerals are being extracted, so the property is worth less. But here we get ourselves in a conundrum because we're not paying real estate taxes on this property. So I guess the assertion in this piece here is that it's not really true that no tax is collected on this income received as royalties, even though the royalty tax has been eliminated. It's just some players, if they don't meet the residency requirement or the corporate, Minnesota company requirement, may be found in a loophole here where they're escaping that tax. Is that a correct characterization?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, I think what I would agree with what you're saying, that yes, this income is taxable to them, and there are certain amounts of it that will end up not being subject to tax. And of course, the bill provides that to the extent that they do pay tax, they will get a credit against that income tax for that, which will reduce the yield from the tax somewhat.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
I was I was trying to follow up from Hurtas, and I had to step out for a second, so I don't think it's been answered. So, Representative Metza, or to a testifier, or even to staff, if this tax was removed in 1986, nothing ever gets done around here without, particularly in the taconite industry, without a deal being cut. Somebody gave up something, or somebody got something. So what did the royalty owners give up in order to get rid of that royalty tax? Because I don't want, if we made it, as a state, made a promise 35 years ago, you know, it's, you have to be careful when you get rid of that promise.
Mr. Cerfenik?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, it's a very good question, and I think the historical record on the movement in 1986 to eliminate the royalty tax was the taconite industry was hurting. There was very, very low production, and the mining companies came to the legislature and said, we pay this tax because of these contracts, and we need a break, and this is a way to give us a temporary break. I don't know if they use that word. I think that would be what a common Iron Range legislator would have heard at that point. but
is there such a thing as a common Iron Range legislator?
I think the facts, Mr. Chairman, the facts point otherwise.
Ah, yes, yes.
Thanks, Gary.
But Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think what happened at that point was it was a way to give the industry a tax break when they were hurting. And one thing that happens in these instances is it goes on for 25 years. And even though there's a contract between two parties, the leaseholders and the mining companies, that says, oh, don't worry, if they tax you, we'll pay it, that's not really a problem that I think you need to deal with. That's a problem they should address in contract negotiations between those two parties. And if the mining industry does not want to pay these taxes, maybe they shouldn't be signing those agreements. And in the future, as they move forward on these mining agreements, I think if you impose some type of excise tax, that you would not see that appear in these contracts any longer. And there is a, I'm a member of this club that owns minerals. My grandfather, in 1932, had 120 acres of land in the Superior National Forest, which he sold to the Superior National Forest for $132. He maintained the severed mineral interests, and now 49 of my close cousins pay taxes on that annually. The tax bill on each acre of land is 40 cents, and it's set, and it doesn't fluctuate. And so we pay that $16 every year to St. Louis County for our 40 acres of mineral rights, hoping that one day, you know, we'll be members of the club that get $114 million, and we get to pay nothing. But I don't think that will come for me or my following generations.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions from members? Representative Hurtas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney raised an interesting question that I hadn't considered. So what I heard on the testimony, is it then possible that when the royalty tax existed, the extraction or the income derived from that, the recipient was paying ordinary income tax for that portion of it, and then in addition, the mining company was paying a royalty tax on top of that, so it was getting taxed in two different parts? Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Cerfenik.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe, Representative, that that was the case.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurtas, I think that, in fact, I do think that was the case, because it's the old Section 61 of the Internal Revenue Code says, you know, income from whatever source derived is taxable unless provides otherwise. Our income tax follows that. Yes, this royalty tax was also imposed and would be would have been a deductible tax in those days. And so, but as it works out, the royalty holders were not in fact paying it because of these contractual relationships. So the mining companies were paying that tax. The royalty owners, the owners of the mineral interests that were getting the royalty payments, were paying a separate, the regular income tax or corporate franchise tax on that income. So you can talk about it being taxed twice, but you know, two different entities really were sort of being.
Representative Hurtas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to Representative Mahoney's statement, then you know that was a correct characterization. And when you say that something never gets, an entity doesn't get something unless they're giving something up, and as you stated, the hard economic times, it was two components of taxation for this activity, and the royalty tax was given up to give them a tax break, and it's never been repealed. So I think all I want to say is I just want to make certain that with as this bill is moving forward and we're talking about it, that there isn't this characterization that the people that are receiving income from the mineral itself are not paying taxes, because that is coming through, as I've heard from Mr. Michaels, as ordinary income tax. So it's not tax-free completely.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say with that, though, they aren't paying as much as they should to my community, in a sense that they're taking a unreplaceable product out of the ground, and the tax dollars could go to New York or other communities that aren't losing that resource.
All right.
He's so much calmer than his predecessor. It's
just not as entertaining, is it? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify regarding House File 2629? Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
Well, either one. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eric Hyland from the law firm of Miserly and Kramer, and I'm here today representing the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. And as Representative Hertaus pointed out, I'd like to draw everybody's attention to what should be in your packet. It's a letter from Craig Pagel, the president of the Iron Mining Association, and he sends his regrets he wasn't able to be here. But I think you kind of hit the nail, Representative Hertaus hit the nail on the head when he made the observation that these excise taxes are in fact paid by the mining companies themselves. And so the proposal in this bill, specifically in Section 9, is opposed by the Iron Mining Association. I'd also like to point out, as the letter kind of delineates, that the state of Minnesota's K-12 education system is benefiting tremendously from both royalty payments from these mining operations, as well as production, occupation, and other taxes that also go to local K-12 education programs, as well as statewide education programs. And I promised Representative Metza that I'd be short. So unless you have any questions, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Questions for the testifier? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 2629? All right. Representative Metza, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to point out for the companies that I have given the option to work with them, and that I would like the people who receive the royalty to pay the tax. And so if they have any suggestions, I've asked them to bring them to me, and I would fully incorporate that into the bill that you have in front of you. And that offer still extends, and I haven't heard anything back at this point in time, but overall we are willing to have that conversation moving forward. And there are many instances in mining where someone can't quite come to an agreement, and you'll see kind of what I'll refer to as a land island in the middle of a production area. And I think that, again, Mr. Cirkvenek laid it out pretty well, that this could be a future contractual deal that maybe the companies don't sign to pay for those taxes.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, did we put this amendment on?
Representative Runbeck, you may have missed. We actually do not have possession of the bill, and so we're unable to amend it.
Just again.
Yeah. But informational hearing, because this is the royalties tax is germane to this committee's jurisdiction. Oh, there. Thank you. Representative Wagenius. Welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 2758 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report. Welcome to the committee. I think this is your first time?
Absolutely.
You didn't bring treats?
No.
I know of your cooking and baking.
Well, I can tell you that if this becomes part of the bill...
The audio wasn't working at the beginning of the hearing. We might not want it to be working right then. Representative Wagenius, to your bill, please.
Thank you very much. And thanks, members, for... I know this is a Friday afternoon, and so I will be brief, but I do want you to understand the problem that I am trying to address.
I bring this bill to you because I know that you're going to be considering a property tax cut for farm acreage, and this bill adds an additional cut for organic farm acreage. It's designed to be administratively simple, no change in valuation, and not plowing of any new ground in terms of implementation. It's an agricultural credit of $5 an acre, $5 times the number of acres. And right now, if you would just look at an acre of agricultural land, if it was $5,000 the acre, it would, the tax right now is $25. This is only for land that is farmed organic under certification or is in the process of becoming organic. So, House research tells me that in 2011, approximately, because there are two different ways of measuring, but approximately a half of 1% of our farm land is organic. So, the bill would cost, and there's a sheet in your folder, I trust, nothing in 2015, but in each year in 16 and 17, it would be $735,000. And what I want to do now is talk to you about the reasons that I am proposing this. There's one reason I want to dwell on, but I want to talk to you mainly about the public benefits of why we should do this. And the first one, and the one I will go back to and tell you a little more about, because Representative Keel is on a committee that I serve on. We've had two hearings about pollinators and the really bad shape there in the state of Minnesota. And I think it's going to take many, many, many small actions to preserve many of them. But if it's an organic farm, it will be a safe place for pollinators. The second reason, the public benefit, is as our traditional farms are priding themselves on reducing workers and having more technology, even robots, then they're having fewer and fewer farm workers. Organic is the opposite. It has many, many jobs per acre. So if there's another way of looking at it, it's jobs per acre. So if you'd go, we have visited Featherstone Farms, for example, in southern Minnesota, and I eat some of their produce, and if my memory serves correct, they farm about 300 acres, and they have 48 employees. The second thing I think this bill does is encourage diversity in agriculture, and the reason I would say that that is important right now is that we have had really strong years of corn and soybean, but from what I understand, those prices are going to drop they have dropped for corn substantially. And so we don't have the stability, and adding diversity would bring stability. And I say that for dairy. This committee probably knows that many of our dairy farms left Minnesota a number of years ago, ended up in California. Now California has no water, and I would hope we would welcome dairy back into Minnesota with open arms because it gives us more diversity, less bounce in income. But there is another reason I'm going to give you another public benefit. It is right now, and I put a sheet in your folder, that in the United States right now, the demand for organic eggs is increasing, but America's farmers aren't growing enough organic corn and soybeans, especially soybeans, to feed their animals. So what we're doing is we're getting the organic soybeans from China. This is what this article says. You'll see it. India and Argentina. So we are shipping corn and soybeans overseas and bringing back organic ones. So again, a value for Minnesota farmers to encourage them
to raise organic crops. So you might want to read this article. It's not intuitive what would be going on. It certainly surprised me. It's a brand new article too. So let me go back to the original reason I put this bill in, and that's because we are losing our pollinators in Minnesota, and we all eat. We have two kinds of pollinators, the wild ones that were in Minnesota before we imported European honeybees. And we know, so I'm going to talk about both of them, but the honeybees, you all are aware, I'm sure, of colony collapse, where we used to have beekeepers would lose 5-7% of their bees a year. Now it's 30%. Those farmers are not even reimbursed for that. But the farmers in Minnesota who raise bees, in a big way anyway, actually take those bees to California and other places to pollinate crops, because California doesn't have pollinators anymore. They have to, literally, for the almond farms, there are no pollinators. They bring bees from Minnesota and other states, and that is one of our big industries, is taking bees to other states for pollinating. That's strawberries and other things, but almonds is the big one that comes to mind. But there are lots of other crops where our farmers who raise bees are taking them to other states. So that's so we have the wild ones, and my guess is, and what we think is happening, is the same thing that's happening to the honeybees is also happening to the wild bees. We don't know much about our wild bees or our other pollinators, but we're losing butterflies. Three butterflies that used to be all over Minnesota have totally disappeared. They're now extinct. The bumblebee used to be very prevalent in Minnesota. It's hard to find anymore. It's rare to find anymore. We don't even know enough about the rest of our pollinators to know how much we've lost. So we have to think about the rate of loss right now, and that's why I bring this bill to you, because what the bill does is give a safe place for pollinators. In Minnesota, because we've had some hearings in our committee, and we have done some things for pollinators, we're having DNR grow additional flowers at the beginning of the season, at the end of the season, so there's food for pollinators throughout the season. Bowser's doing some work in a similar fashion. In the scheme of things, these are minuscule in terms of acreage. So I am particularly worried about our wild pollinators what organic agriculture does is provide acreage for both food and habitat. If you don't know, I mean, we think of bees and colonies and white boxes and on our farm, that's what they are, in white boxes in the back of the woods. But for wild pollinators, if they're bees, they have little holes in the ground and they live underground. And who'd have known it, right? So I just want to go back and remind you that there is a list of public benefits, and lots of people will come and say, oh, we can't do this because we don't do this kind of thing anymore. But I'm going to say in this case, the public benefits outweigh our desire to keep the number of slots or of property taxes in very few slots. So, with that, I'm glad to take questions.
Thank you, Representative Wiginius. Representative Faust.
I guess I don't necessarily have a question for you, but just a couple of comments to support what you've been saying. When somebody decides they want to go to organic farming, they have to not use any fertilizer chemical for, I believe, 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so the production is going to go down, but their expenses don't go down by nearly as much. And so it really, they have to get through those 3 years before they start getting an increased price for their product. And so what this credit will do is it will help them get through that time so that they won't have quite, you know, reduce their expense a little bit while they're doing that. But the thing that, that appeals to me the most about what you said was the pollinators, because when I was growing up, my father raised certified sunflower seed, and so we put those boxes of bees out, you know, throughout the field. And when I was driving the combine up and down the field, when you drive next to the box of where the beehives had been, you could see by how quickly the sunflowers were coming into the combine that you were next to a beehive. And you drive 100 feet away, and it would slow down. And then you get closer to one, and it would start coming in faster again. And yet, you know, we just take it for granted that, you know, all of these crops are going to be pollinated. But the impact that that made just within a field, and yet there are bees all over the place in the field, but right next to the hives. And so my whole point is that just how important those are to the production of agriculture throughout the country. Without it, you know, would we have pecans? Would we have peaches? Would we have apples? And the answer is, in many cases, no, we would not. And so, so you know, I think that what you said is that this might not be the silver bullet, but what we need is a whole bunch of little bullets to try to fix the problem. But it's a growing problem and a growing concern. And if we don't fix it, not just us are going to run out of food, but the whole world is going to run out of food. So thank you for bringing us.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I was kind of curious. What happens during that three-year period in preparation? I assume it's so that no chemicals and so on are put on the land.
Yes.
But if you could expand on that, that's just for my curiosity. I think the bill itself is just really a good idea.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, people can grow things, but they cannot claim them to be organically certified. And what, of course, you're aiming for is organic certification, because what you can get for your product is a lot higher, and, of course, the demand for organic certification is going up. But it is that transition period, and I think you're right that that is the big stumbling block.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the reason I asked that question was kind of a follow-up, because then there would be some production off the land for that three-year period.
Mm-hmm. Could be. Yep.
Totally dormant. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Just a comment to the growing of the crops. Part of the reason the price is higher is because there's less. It isn't as productive. Because of the weeds take over. I have an organic farmer right near me, butts up against a lot of my land, and so I see the difference in the weed issues. But by the way, I do have a lot of bumblebees in my yard. I had to remove a flower from my back door because my grandchildren were scared to death. It was so full of bumblebees. But my question is how do we know how much subsidies we do for organic farmers as compared to conventional?
Representative Wagenius.
Oh, boy, I don't want to. I would prefer not to get into that, because then we're seeing what do you include as subsidy? Do you include water as subsidy? The fact that, I mean, for you guys, you may not have been hearing it, but for us and our committee, we have heard that we have so much nitrogen pollution in our land from excess fertilizer or just fertilizer getting into the land, that some of our cities, and I'll say Park Rapids as an example, Park Rapids has just had to put in a new filtration system to get rid of the nitrogen. The cost of to each resident in Park Rapids for their water is 25% higher. That's, Park Rapids is not one place. I could tell you about St. Peter. I can tell you about Hastings. There are lots of other places, and this is one of the things that is going up. So I don't even know what to include in the word subsidy. But I mean, in contrast, I think that's a huge discussion. I just gave you an example.
Representative Kuehl.
Well, I probably have to agree with her. There are a lot of different things we do for different farmers, or different groups, I guess, an area. And we probably see it a little differently, what we do, as far as nitrogen. And there's other reasons for nitrogen in the ground. And so, just to state, as a farmer, There are a lot of things we are doing these days to control how much chemical we put down, how much fertilizer we put down, potassium, nitrogen. And because, as Representative Bouguinas alluded to, the technology that we now use, we have a greater ability to control quite a bit of what we do on the farm and save a lot more on water and just fuel going over the field and those kinds of things. But, you know, we've discussed pollinators considerably in Environment Committee, and while I understand that's really important, I'm sure there are other ways. We're talking about ditches and mowing and those kinds of things, but I think we need to be careful what we're doing with the funding too, how much we're doing, and I don't know as I'm against it. I'm just not sure where I'm at with it. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Keel. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wagenius and I discovered a few years back that her ancestors and my husband's ancestors settled not too far from each other in Hoffman, Minnesota, Hoffman, Minnesota, Douglas County. So I know your family still farms there. Will you be benefiting from this tax credit? Are you farming organic?
Representative Wagenius.
Okay. First of all, we do not farm. We do have a farm. It is classified as recreational, and that classification will not change. What really goes on at our farm is a research station, and there is lots of things are grown, but they are grown as research projects, not as something that you harvest and sell. Nothing is sold from our farm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious. But if I could make a comment, we had a discussion about an hour ago about something called SFIA. This sounds like another SFIA to me. And you have the whole issue, again, of compliance and monitoring and registering. And so you just kind of wonder. I don't see any difference myself. We could end up 10 years later with the same report that the tax benefits are diverging from what the purpose was.
Representative Wagenius?
If I could respond to that, I think the organic certification is well established, and I don't, unlike the SFIA where there isn't that kind of registration, it's extremely well established. There are strict criteria. I'm sure you know about the criteria for that, and so I don't see them in the same boat at all.
I'm just thinking the Sustainable Organic Farm Act, SOFA.
Representative Faust.
Yeah, if I could just...
I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
Are you referring to then a federal program? Our own state?
Oh, stop.
State.
It was a joke. My apologies.
I see.
Yeah. Oh, Representative Hertas, I'm sorry, you've been patient. Representative Faust, I apologize.
Mine's in reference to Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I really didn't have an idea about the trucking of bees all over the country, but 3 years ago I was talking to an adjacent property owner in another state. He has a pecan grove, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, we're loading up our bees to take them to California now." And they own these bees and move them all around. But the pollinator issue is a serious issue. I applaud you for wanting to do something about it, but the two concerns I have is with regard to increasing habitat through this credit. I don't think $5 an acre encourages anybody to go into organic farming. I don't think the amount of organic acres or the organic farm area is going to increase as a result of this credit, nor do I believe it will keep people in organic farming as a sustainable method, because $5 an acre in agriculture today is hardly anything. The other concern I have is with regard to the pollinators. I could do that on my farm in Hennepin County, and yet I am growing GMO modified corn in other areas, and so there's nothing to keep the pollinators in a specific place. So even though we do this, you know, they don't have shackles on them. They fly to the next thing they want to try and do their job, and the habitat and the insecticides and whatever really is central at the issue. So I applaud the effort to do more for pollinators, but I don't know that this gets at the core of the problem.
Representative Genius.
This does not get at the core of the problem. If we were to get at the core of the problem, we would say that we could not use systemic pesticides in Minnesota. That would get at the core of the problem. However, I don't expect that to happen. So what I think we have to do is we have to come up with a bucket full of small things. But one small thing isn't going to work. Two small things aren't going to work. 10 aren't. We're going to have to come up with a whole bunch of different things. When you said that $5 is not going to be enough incentive, that's actually 20%. The first number I gave you was on a $5,000 acre, the tax would be $25, so a $5 cut would be a 20% cut. And members, I'll tell you one other thing that you wouldn't know about, is a long time ago I did come before this committee and do something called This Old House. And this was a bill that I struggled to get done, and it was to give a property tax reduction for 10 years just on the added value of adding to a house. Maybe a lot of you don't even know about it. And the reason I did it is because people were so scared of adding on or upgrading old houses. This was only for old houses because they thought their property taxes would go up. When I started it, my city, which is Minneapolis, was against it because they thought they'd be losing too much property tax revenue. But as we talked it through, and it took a long time, the city began to realize it probably wouldn't lose very much, and if it would encourage people to invest in their homes, it would be a good thing, and over time, Minneapolis would have a better tax base. And that's what happened. It was a 10-year program. It had a sunset, but that is what happened. There was a lot of investment, and I would hear from people, well, I just put a room on, I put a porch on, I redid my kitchen, and I did it because my property taxes won't go up because of that. Minneapolis, and this was not just for Minneapolis, but I knew the Minneapolis numbers. Minneapolis then looked at what happened to taxes, it didn't lose any money. That's not the way it worked out. And I expect this to be very similar to that. It's just that sometimes you've got to get over that psychological hurdle of doing something.
Representative Faust, thank you for your patience.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to comment just briefly on what Representative Keel and Representative Runbeck said. First of all, the big difference between this and the SFIA program is that when a farmer is certified organic, they have to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that there was no fertilizer chemicals used, that the seed they used was certified organic, that, you know, that all of those things are done. And so there's a tremendous follow-up on that to make sure that that is done, whereas, as we heard in the SFIA program, it's kind of, well, we hope you follow the law, and there isn't that much follow-up is what I kind of took from that. And as far as what we do for the organic farmers is, I believe the state pays for half of that $500 charge, not that your answer was wrong, but just more specifically that the Ag Department does pay for $250 of that. Now, those numbers are a couple of years ago that I last heard them, but the last I heard that's what it was. So just wanted to add that.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify regarding House File 2758?
Oh, yeah.
I figured that's why you were in the back row.
When did you sneak in here?
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Gloria Pinky, and I'm a manager in Dakota County Assessing Services, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. First off, I'd like to make it very clear that our association has no opposition to the goals that Representative Wagenius is laying out. I commend her for trying to solve some of the environmental problems that are associated with pollination and growing organic farms, etc. Our opposition is strictly to the mechanism in which that is being proposed. The $5 credit, while it is a state-paid credit,
And we appreciate that because the money will come from the state general fund in the end. It seems like the proposal to have assessors take applications and monitor the program is a roundabout way of solving that, of reaching that goal. The State Department of Agriculture certifies organic farms. They then tell Department of Revenue who those people are, who has the could possibly apply. Then Revenue has to set up procedures, policies, forms, revise their computer forms to accommodate all that new data. And they send it to 87 counties in the state who may or may not have organic farms, or may have one or may have many more within each individual county, who could even potentially receive this $5 per acre credit. Then the treasurers and assessors, counties have to work with their county computer consortiums or independent computer vendors to program for that $5 per acre credit. It doesn't just happen, and we don't have that currently in our systems. So anytime you deal with computer vendors and say, oh, we have to come up with a new field, a new way to account for the number of acres that are eligible for this credit, all that costs money. And I did, while I'm thinking of that, I did look at the revenue note, and I don't see any note, any indication on here on how much it's going to cost counties in order to implement this program. So I don't have a clue how much it would be, but I know it's not cheap when I go back to my computer vendor and say, we need to program for this legislative change because it's a brand new thing. So please keep that in mind. So anyway, the counties then gather all this information, enter all the information, compile it, figure out how much tax dollars should be credited on each statement. We send that data back to Department of Revenue, who then issues a check or reimburses the taxing jurisdictions for the amount that's lost. So it starts at the state, it ends at the state. The credit, the $5 tax credit, really is not based on property taxes at all. It's a $5 per acre. It's not based on the market value or the tax in that specific jurisdiction. If you're in a low tax area or a high tax area, you're still getting the same $5 per acre. So it really is not based any way, shape, or form on market values or property taxes other than a $5 credit per acre. And I see this as monitoring and maintaining a system annually and updating records based on how many acres qualified this year and how many qualified last year. I think that is going to be it could be a significant added cost, and it's going to vary greatly between the 87 counties. I did look at the Department of Ag report because this is a new area for me, and I've been around longer than I like to think. We've never done anything special or different for different types of farms. So I decided I better look at the Department of Agriculture's report on organic farms. They got a nice publication, which I discovered yesterday. And in there, they list 215 organic farmers. Those farmers range from a 1 acre poultry turkey operation to a 2,300 acre cattle operation in Fillmore County. So the impacts are going to vary widely from location to location to location, and maybe that's the intent, but I did want to call that to your mind. We do appreciate the Assessors Association are grateful that Representative Wagenius is putting this on a bill that at least it's being paid for by the states and not by local governments, but it just seems a very roundabout way to start at the state, has nothing to do with tax calculation or values, and then refund it in the end. Just maybe you want to just, my proposal or suggestion is send the organic farmers a check for $5 for whatever acres they have in from the state general fund and skip all the in-between stuff.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Pinkham.
And I think it is SFIA.
Representative Runbeck?
Mr. Chair, I think it is SFIA.
All right. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify regarding House File 2758? Any questions from members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel.
Thank you. I want to remind the members here that there are also other things happening. I've talked to some of our seed companies because there's issues with seed when it's planted in the ground. It is creating some deaths in bees. But there are some things up and coming to help protect bees. So while this is one way to help protect our pollinators, agriculture also understands that it needs to be doing something because those bees help pollinate all kinds of crops, not just organic, and it is very important to our ecological system. So I believe you'll see some changes real fast. They're working on it.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Closing comments, Representative Lagunius?
Well, I would like to respond just to both the last. When I did this old house, it was enough years ago. We didn't have the computer systems we had today. It was a far more complex bill, and assessors got it done. So I have every expectation that they could get this done. In terms of the seed issue, you all probably don't know this, and I didn't want to get into this very deeply, but every corn seed that is not organic is treated with a neonicotinoid systemic pesticide. And when those are put into the ground with the machinery we have today, that creates a dust that just kills the bees like that. Then there's the question of it being in the ground for 4 or 5 years. It is persistent. And what else is growing up in that ground? Flowers, the bee comes, visits it, and maybe she cannot get back to its hive because the neonicotinoids are designed to kill pests, of course. Well, they also kill friendly things, too.
All right.
So, I appreciate all your time and would be glad to visit with any of you all individually.
Thank you all thank you very much. Members and members of the public, please be aware we are going to be scheduling an additional hearing on Monday. Time to be and agenda to be determined. Look for a posting. We will be bringing out the division report on Tuesday and marking it up Wednesday evening. So look for postings there. Thank you very
Mr.
much.
Chair, any idea on time on Monday?
We've got a couple in the afternoon. Oh, look at how big her eyes got.
We've got 2 or 4.
Okay, good. Late.
So during working hours. Well, they're all working hours here. During business hours.
No, they're not all working hours. This is a part-time job.
Not from midnight to 8 in the morning.
But that would be part-time.
No.
It doesn't say what part of the time.
Anytime after 5 on Monday, you're not going to get much response.
Got it. Thank you all. We stand adjourned.